So, wir haben gerade beschlossen, dass wir jetzt pünktlich starten mit der heutigen Veranstaltung. Und ich darf Deutsch sprechen, weil unsere Referentin in Englisch spricht, aber auch sehr gut Deutsch versteht und spricht. Deswegen ist es nicht unhöflich, sondern ich darf jetzt sozusagen die mir leichter fallende Sprache nutzen. Ich darf Sie begrüßen zur heutigen Gender Lecture, die den Auftakt auch macht, gleichzeitig zu der Serie der Gender Lectures, auf die wir nachher nochmal kurz zu sprechen kommen. Mein Name ist Susanne Maurer und ich bin die zurzeit amtierende geschäftsführende Direktorin des Zentrums für Gender Studies und feministische Zukunftsforschung. Und dieses Zentrum, kurz auch Genderzentrum genannt, der Uni Marburg, veranstaltet seit einigen Jahren immer wieder im Wintersemester sogenannte Gender Lectures zu unterschiedlichen Schwerpunktthemen. Dies ist jetzt sozusagen eine weitere Fortsetzung der Gender Lectures und wir freuen uns sehr, wir sind ja auch zu dritt, sozusagen derzeit aktiv und arbeitend im Genderzentrum. Wir freuen uns sehr, Sie heute hier begrüßen zu dürfen. Wir haben dieses Mal eine rein englischsprachige Reihe. Im letzten Wintersemester haben wir eigentlich so eine Art ersten Teil gehabt, auch zum Thema globale Aufbrüche, neue Protestbewegungen, Gestalten des Protestes, des Nicht-Einverstanden-Seins, Demokratisierungsversuche in verschiedenen gesellschaftlichen Kontexten, hatten da auch ganz spannende Vorträge, Kolleginnen hier, die über den Winter und dann nochmal einen Vortrag später nachgeholt, auch Themen beleuchtet haben, die in diesem Zusammenhang stehen. Und ich freue mich, dass wir jetzt hier ein Stück weit anknüpfen und fortsetzen können. Wie es dazu kam und wie es auch zum Themenschwerpunkt der diessemestrigen Gender Lectures kam, dazu Veronika Ott.
Also der Titel der diesjährigen, Gender Lectures lautet Globale Aufbrüche, Fragezeichen, Formen feministischen Widerstands in Ost- und Mitteleuropa. Auch in Ost- und Mitteleuropa hat quasi die globale ökonomische Krise zu einem Anstieg von Erwerbsarbeitslosigkeit und einem Anstieg von Armut geführt. Es gibt Tendenzen einer Autorisierung von Politik, wie sich zum Beispiel sehr deutlich in Ungarn sehen lässt. Es gibt steigenden Rechtspopulismus, Klerikalismus, es gibt Rassismus und Homophobie und Gewalt an Roma und auch ein Erstarken traditioneller Geschlechterbilder. Wobei wir hier nicht sagen wollen, dass das alles nur in Ost- und Mitteleuropa existiert, es existiert auch hier. Feminismus und feministische Bewegungen waren lange Zeit und sind es vielleicht auch heute noch nicht das Erste, was einem so im Kopf kommt, wenn man an Ost- und Mitteleuropa denkt. Und in den letzten Jahren wurde das Thema aber in westlichen Medienberichten vermehrt aufgegriffen, vor allem durch so antifeministische oder homophobe Ereignisse, wie zum Beispiel so gewaltvolle Gegenproteste, zum Beispiel gegen Gay-Pride-Paraden oder in letzter Zeit in Russland der Gerichtsprozess gegen Pussy Riots. Und vor dem Hintergrund von diesen gesellschaftlichen, politischen und ökonomischen Veränderungen und gleichzeitig im Kontext, dass es sich um postsozialistische Staaten handelt, wollen wir quasi hier diskutieren, wie sich in diesem Kontext feministische Widerstandsformen gestalten, wie sich feministische Gegenöffentlichkeiten entstehen und organisieren und wie sich Proteste gestalten. Wir haben vier Vorträge organisiert. Der Einstiegsvortrag heute von Hanna Havelkova, grob zum Thema Möglichkeiten und Schwierigkeiten feministischer Solidarität zwischen Feministinnen aus Ost und West. Es wird einen zweiten Vortrag geben, Anfang Dezember, von Andrea Petö aus Budapest, wo es um die Frage gehen wird von rechtsextremistischen Politiken und Geschlecht und die Frage, wie Feminismus da intervenieren kann. Im Januar wird es einen dritten Vortrag geben von Ercebet Barat, ebenfalls aus Budapest, und sie wird diskutieren die aktuelle Situation von Roma, Rassismus gegen Roma am Beispiel der Bildungspolitik, soweit ich weiß, und wird verschiedene feministische Kämpfe gegen diesen Rassismus aufzeigen. Und abgeschlossen wird die Vortragsreihe mit einem Vortrag von Eva Majewska aus der Uni Krakau mit der Frage nach politischer Solidarität und aktuellen feministischen Kämpfen in Polen unter einer postkolonialen Perspektive. Genau.
So. Und wichtig finde ich noch, dass Veronika Ott und Gundula Ludwig die Reihe vorbereitet und initiiert haben und deswegen auch im Moment hat Veronika Ott die Reihe vorgestellt.
Genau, mein Name ist Barbara Grubner und ich bin seit 1. Oktober im Zentrum für Gender Studies als wissenschaftliche Geschäftsführerin, eben die Nachfolgerin von Gundula Ludwig. Und ja, ich möchte Sie auch ganz herzlich begrüßen und darf heute die erste Gastreferentin vorstellen, Frau Doktorin Hanna Havelkova. Sie ist Soziologin. Sie unterrichtet an der Fakultät für humanistische Studien der Karls-Universität in Prag, und zwar zu den Themen Gesellschaftstheorie, Demokratietheorie und feministische Theorien. Ich möchte gern drei Aspekte aus den letzten Aktivitäten auch oder wichtige Aktivitäten herausgreifen. Sie ist Mitbegründerin der Abteilung für Gender Studies an der Fakultät für humanistische Studien der Karls-Universität und, glaube ich, dort auch Mitinitiatorin des Masterstudiums. Ja. Dann war sie 2002 bis 2004 Mitglied in der Expertinnengruppe der Europäischen Kommission zum Thema Frauen in der Wissenschaft in postkommunistischen Ländern. Und aus dieser Zusammenarbeit resultiert auch ein Bericht mit dem Titel Wasted Talents, Turning Private Struggles into a Public Issue. Also da ist sie Mitautorin, Mitherausgeberin. Sie ist Vorstandsmitglied der bekannten Zeitschrift LOM, das ist die Europäische Zeitschrift für feministische Geschichtswissenschaft. Vielleicht nochmal kurz die Forschungsschwerpunkte sind politische Repräsentation von Frauen in der Tschechischen Republik, dann Frauenbewegung und Gender im Realsozialismus. Ja, sie hat sehr viele Publikationen veröffentlicht in tschechischer Sprache, in englischer und in deutscher. Ich möchte gern drei herausgreifen, exemplarisch. Zum Beispiel The Political Representation of Women in Mass Media Discourse in the Czech Republic von 1999 oder Dreifache Enteignung und eine unterbrochene Chance, der Prager Frühling und die Frauen- und Geschlechterdiskussion in der Tschechoslowakei, erschienen eben in LOM 2009. Und ganz aktuell ein Forschungsprojekt, zu dem gerade die Publikation erscheint, mit dem Titel Transformation der Geschlechterkultur der tschechischen Gesellschaft 1948 bis 1989. Und der Vortrag heute nimmt Bezug auch auf dieses Forschungsprojekt. Es wird Material, das untersucht wurde, aus diesem Forschungsprojekt verwenden, und zwar bezogen auf die East-West-Divide, also Ost-West-Differenz, Spannung, bezogen auf feministische Konzepte, die Unterschiede oder die möglichen Unterschiede oder und so weiter, das werden wir gleich hören, und eben zwischen westlichen Gesellschaften und ehemals sozialistischen Ländern. Der Vortrag heißt Concept of Feminist Difference East-West Revised, und ja, damit darf ich Frau Havelkova um ihren Vortrag bitten.
Thank you. Einen schönen Abend, danke für die Einladung. Jetzt werde ich also auf Englisch weitersprechen. Yeah, the theme East-West divide or possible collaboration, I decided to grasp on a certain roundabout, indirectly, because I really don't know what's in the heads of my Western feminist colleagues exactly. What I know is that in the 90s, I was quite active part of the starting new East-West feminist divide. We met at plenty of conferences, and there was, as you may know, also certain misunderstanding, mutual not understanding, and from the Eastern part, post-communist scholars, there was often the argument that our experience is different. So, as already you said, the concept of difference was quite strong at that time, during the whole 90s. Now, the concept of difference itself has contents. In which sense the women's experience or women's wishes or mentalities, even terrible thing, in the post-communist Europe is or should be different. So there was a whole narration came to existence, whole narrative, you know, what was different, what was specific. Now, almost 20 years or 15 years after this narration came to existence, recent research goes after all in depth, because in the 90s the base, the knowledge base of this narration was actually partly positivistic, based on statistics. So statistics were compared of women's employment, kindergartens, etc. So thus the different status of women from the East very often said, we had it better, we had better infrastructure, our women are more emancipated. Very often you could hear that. So this is really almost an ideological structure which became rather rigid. Only recently, there is a new research, not only our, which I will be referring to later on, but as I see also in other countries, also some Western scholars undertake a research of another kind, you know, not so much based on statistics, not so much based only on this, on women's public or social status and its comparisons. And what I very, very soon actually started rejecting, not speaking about what are Czech, Polish, Hungarian, Russian women like, because this is a terrible generalization and terrible construction in itself, of course, you know. But we rather speak about how gender was construed, you know, gender culture, gender meanings, you know, the milieu, actually the cultural milieu of in which men and women were living, you know, how they're like. So I very often heard feminism a dirty word. Czech women do reject feminism. I'm Czech women and I don't reject feminism, so am I not a Czech woman or what, you know? So this kind, it was really too much, simplified, too much generalized. There was also this sort of representation of certain scholars who were telling these narratives. And we actually started breaking that, you know? Interestingly enough, only after this 20 years, when we start doing really a new research, different research, and as I will try to show you, the very many of the assumptions and hypotheses and claims really proved untrue, you know, proved false or just half truth, you know. So what I will be presenting today is an attempt to correct or to revise the very contents of the alleged difference or specificities, although it's all only on Czech materials. It's by purpose so, because the research comprises is 13 members of the team, researchers. Is interdisciplinary, and the analysis went very much in depth. So this is something you can't do benchmarking, you know, you can't try to compare. It would be, again, these superficial stories, which we already have plenty of, you know. You can really compare statistics, and even that, it's not for sure. Okay, so new type of research started, as I noticed, discourse analysis of various kinds, also shop floor experiences of women, memories of women. That was another step after this, you know. So oral history, biographies was a very important shift from this first way of targeting the issue. But as I will try to explain you, it's not enough either, because it still reproduces certain bipolar, dichotomic pattern of explanation, which we also try to break in the research. So, as it was already said, the research is called Transformation of Gender Culture in the Czech Society, 1948 to 1989. It was running 2009 to 2011. Now it's in print. The context of the research is, I think, quite relevant also to mention, because in the year 2000, I thought nobody's interested anymore in the issue East-West feminism, East-West women in post-communist countries. But it turned out that this was a false assumption, because as I already said, actually proper empirical research of the period, it was more than 40 years, you know, where gender culture really has been transformed, and nobody knew exactly how. So research was really missing. It may seem unbelievable, but it was so because scholarship was missing. So until recently, I think 5 years ago, I couldn't be able to put such a team together. So the team consists really of young postdocs who studied abroad, who know the recent analytical approaches and methods, and who really knew how to apply gender as an analytical concept. So the development in scholarship is a very important part of the whole story. Another part of the story is that the younger generation, our students, for example, students of the gender studies program, they really utter a big uncertainty about what's the local culture. They feel very sharply that there's something which does make the difference, which we inherited from the communist past, but they don't know anymore what it is. Yeah, so that's another a new interest actually in the topic, which I wouldn't have expected, frankly, to say frankly. So another push or the incentive is that in the historical scene there is a new approach to the communist past, which tries to break the ideological way of targeting that. But in this research, gender is missing. Gender perspective is totally missing, absent, you know, which is almost a scandal. So it was actually our duty to do that. What is different in this new historical approach, which is also done mostly by very young postdocs, is that they try to break the so-called totalitarian explanatory model. What is that? Totalitarian explanatory model is that you depict the situation as the oppressive regime on the one side and the oppressed people on the other side. But as we all know, the reality is far richer and far more complex, you know. I will show you later on the example of expats that it's so hard to really say big groups of people who was the regime, who belonged to the society. It's not so simple. And this regime, this approach actually had a sort of exculping, how you call it, Entschuldigungsfunktion, that you could see that was the regime and the society was a victim, you know. But as we all know now, it's very delicate, but this very simple and by binary approach must be really deconstructed as well. So we do the same, but in the field of gender analysis. In a sense, this new feminist research, for example, by Shayna Penn and Jill Massino, who try to work with oral history, memories of women, this is a very good, very important shift, but it does not completely break this binary approach either, because it stopped analyzing the power elite policies, which was the case before, and starts analyzing the other part of the opposition, you know, the other side of the opposition, just the objects of the policies. But there were very many actors in between. So we concentrated on gender culture and gender relations, not on men and women. I have to skip because it's too long. And as I said, we used actually only Czech material of all sorts, archival materials of all kind, film, literature, media, texts, and maybe I will explain more in the discussion. I'm sorry, because I said all that already. Okay. So we were focusing on the way how power elites and intellectual elites were construing gender. The focus was on a wide range of actors and their acting to trace their role in forming of, generally speaking, local gender culture. We did not research or speculate on their real impact. We analyzed various discourses, we used discourse analysis, oral history, historiography, and other methods. In order to break the above-mentioned binary approach, great emphasis was put on the role of experts, who, as the Hungarian sociologists put it, Ildikó Asztalos Morell, I quote, that the experts were the mediators of the gender contract, mediators between political goals and the shop floor experiences, end of quote. In our project, production of following expert groups was in the state socialist era was subject to analysis. So products of lawyers, sociologists, psychologists, demographers, sexologists. Focus was also on selected works by intellectual elite production, literature and film, but also on Spartakiad performances. Do you know what Spartakiads were? It was this max exercise on huge stadiums where people were exercising, they were training for that for months. There was music especially composed for that. You never have seen some of that? Spartakiad, yeah. There's something very special, and there was, of course, in the scenarios, very strong, always gender context, gender meanings. So we were analyzing, other words, gender as social category and a symbolic category. Now I would like to make you acquainted with some interesting results. I still do have in mind this basic question of the feminism East-West, but as you will see, one has to really know well the one side at least properly, and then you can conclude what consequences for the relationship that can be drawn. Okay, some interesting results of our research, because they are really quite new, at least in our context, and they were very rich and very interesting, sometimes very surprising. So they were concepts. Some of the concepts which, as I said, were part of the narratives were put in doubt through the research, and I decided in my presentation to connect the findings with how they deconstruct the extant concept. So I will be speaking about half-truths or myths or concepts such as force emancipation, state feminism, feminism as imported from the West, men as a weaker sex, solidarity between the sexes, meaning under communism, and then a certain periodization, first revolution, then conservative turn. All of those concepts, which are very much commonly shared, believe me, in this, can be really revised, as I promised in the title of my paper. Okay. So, the first and probably most dominant group of concepts is that of forced emancipation, or in other words, emancipation from above. This claim is a typical example of the totalitarian explanatory model approach in the gender field. The concept was based partly on alleged facts, which didn't prove true, such as obligatory employment of women, partly on an axiom, on another false concept, that feminism or emancipation was something artificially implanted to local culture just on the basis of Marxist doctrine. What are our findings as related to this concept? The precise legal analysis, the first really such proper analysis in our country by the lawyer Barbara Havelková, documented that the legal duty to work was in power only at the beginning of the 1950s, and even then, it was in only a limited way applied to women, not to mention mothers. The sociological stuff analyzed by Veronika Šprincová documents that indeed women's employment was growing after the communists take over, but only very gradually And the difference between the percentage of women working outside the home did not differ much in the 1930s and 1950s. So we should ask, where's the origin of that commonly shared but incorrect picture? Barbara Havercroft notices in her chapter on the base on her analysis of the legislation during the whole 40 years that the current image of gender politics in state socialism may match the situation in the very early 50s, but not the rest of the period. So this is itself very interesting. Why is it so? Why we still do depict the era just on the base of first 3, 4, 5 years? It's a very interesting. So you can ask cui bono. It's also, it's a certain ideology in it, which I can then discuss perhaps later in the discussion. Others? Sorry. And probably more important arguments against the concept of forced emancipation is the fact that in basic ideology, equal rights of women and men were certainly part of the image or propaganda of the new society, but the concrete elaboration and the introduction into life was very soon put in the hands of experts. First, it was the lawyers who were soon followed by demographers, then sociologists, somewhat later by psychologists. In my own part of the research project, I concentrated on the institution called State Population Commission, which was launched in 1958, and it was an institution most in charge of gender-relevant issues. You can't imagine how broad, how rich, how much they were doing in gender. So one of the myths is that there was no gender research under communism. It's not true, you know. Very much of that, although positivistic and limited according to that time, but actually very similar like in all other countries. So there was research on population, family, and women being its main focus. It can be easily documented that the creation of the concrete governmental policies was very soon, that is from 1956 on, delegated on this commission, or its predecessors, which collaborated with other social research institutions very intensely. Moreover, the researchers were closely and permanently monitoring the life strategies and attitudes of women, family relations, and were initiating gradual adjusting of the governmental policies to the needs of women, though identified only through surveys, that is on quantitative data based on closed questions. So there was no qualitative research, unfortunately, so which was a big lack, of course. In one of the first surveys, at the end of 50s, the researcher found out that women were not willing to have more than one child if more children would affect their work activities. So women themselves did want to work for whatever reasons. So even the main argument in favor of the concept of forced emancipation, that is, the forced work, turned out to be more complex. Of course, the reasons why women themselves found it important to be employed varied from economic necessity to just loving your job or loving your working team. But important is that through the research of that time, not only shop floor experiences entered the decisions by authorities, but that the service may represent certain pressure from below, which can be shown there was a population decline in the 50s, they must say that, yeah? So when they found out that there's a population decline, they started asking women. The surveys were huge, 10,000 sample. You wouldn't get financing today for such researches, you know? So the state generously funded this research because it needed the feedback by the population. So I was surprised myself when I saw the extent of all that work. The pressure from below, because the imagine that the communist regime only wanted women to work, to make the labor force from them, very soon changed when they saw that women would not have children, that they would prefer the work before the children. So they very quickly redefined their politics and started support motherhood. The maternal leave was prolonged so that it in the 70s was the longest in the world. So you could easily depict the communist era not as the working women society, but as a mother cult society. Quite easily, you could easily create such a narrative, and you would be right as well, you know. So this is, I think, very interesting, because what was the expert? Were their regime, were their society? What did they represent? So no doubt, the monitoring activities were there to serve social engineering, no doubt. And the so-called rational governing of the society in the first place, but not solely. The researchers were, for their part, interested in women's well-being, were dealing with issues such as changes in sexual pleasure in women due to the availability of contraceptives or abortion right, or last but not least, with the democratization of the family. It was also a very big issue. Certainly, they were all the time working on the issue, what we nowadays call the harmonization of care and work. As to the systems of care outside the family, these researchers were, against the common shared assumption, especially in the 1960s, in the close contact with colleagues from all over Europe. They were attending conferences, they were exchanging data and models and similar. So especially they took examples or patterns from France, Sweden, and Poland. I'm saying this not to idealize the system, which I really hated, believe me, and paint it pink, but to point at the fact that many of the extant concepts are just counterfactual. So we may hate the regime, but we mustn't tell a new untruth, new lies or incorrect information. Growing word in the process of the adjustment of the governmental policies to the life got the psychologists and their deprivation theories. That started in the 60s. These theories came at that time, by the way, from the West. As a result, the maternity leave has been gradually prolonged, as I said, so that in the second half of the communist era, it became the longest in the world. 4 years, three years of that, the whole 4 years, you could get some benefit from the social benefit from the state. Until 3 years, the employer was obliged to keep your job, your position, etc. So as I said, the communist era could be easily interpreted as, in the opposite way, as a maternal cult. Part of the argument of the forced emancipation started from the conviction that the communist regime was emancipating women only via employment. As I mentioned above, within the expert activities, there was serious interest from the beginning also in the issue of democratization of family. As Veronika Sprintzova, another colleague, I will name all my colleagues actually, because I don't want, because it's so rich, it would be a pity to present only my own findings. So she demonstrates this was one of the central lines in the work of sociologists, prevalently women, who were dealing with the gender-relevant issues in quite great complexity. This is also interesting because, as Ildikó Astalos-Morell, whom I already quoted, she analyzed expertise on the labor market, and there she claims that the experts were men, and the object of research were women, but this was, in this case, it was different. So my argument is that not only there is a question what means from above, whether the experts are to be regarded as those who belong more to the power or to the society. Certainly they were standing at least in between. One can argue that in the end they were still just the servants of the regime, that one has to be cautious with even this assumption. Convincingly documents another colleague of the team, the historian Vera Sokolova, in her chapter on homosexuality and on sexual policy in general. She's combining oral history, interviews with lesbians and gays, with the analysis of institutional practices of the sexology and sexologists. She shows that the role of acting of the experts or doctors was extremely complex, and among other things, that the ambulances sometimes transformed to the first gay clubs, protected by the doctors. She shows also tricks how the doctors prevented secret policy to access to the documentation, or other tricks how to deal with censorship. I can explain in detail if you'd be interested more on these things in the discussion. Another part of my argument opposing the thesis of the enforced emancipation is ideological. As I already pointed out on several occasions, the gender-relevant modernizing agenda that was included in the new Czech constitution and individual legal codes, such as family law, labor code in 1949, corresponded with the goals of both Marxist and liberal feminisms of the first wave, and to some extent also to the second wave. So I checked the list, the so-called list of the rights of women issued by the American National Organization of Women in 1967 was really identical with the emancipatory program which was introduced in the legislation, communist legislation from 1949. All the points were actually matching. The idea that ideology of emancipation was not part of the local tradition is, of course, also fully false. What happened after the communist takeover was the liquidation of the so far well-developed scene of women's activism. As another member of our team, the historian Denis Hanečasová, documented in a precise way on archival materials, the process of liquidation was gradual. I will skip on that. The important thing of this story is, with the movement, is that the Czechoslovak Union of Women, who was to replace the previous bourgeois women's organization, was also stopped by the regime in as early as in 1952 and revived only in only 15 years later during the Prague Spring. In between, there was only a representation of 80 women who were just there to communicate with abroad with international organizations, etc. Important is that at the time when the new legislation was written, that is 1948 and 49, the inherited feminist agenda, pre-communist agenda, was still there, and the requirements were formulated. For example, the communist family law was all created by the pre-communist group of feminist lawyers. So you can really ask where is the idea of enforced emancipation comes from? Well, this, you know, this package is actually wrong, counterfactual. Given this account, instead of operating with the concept of enforced emancipation from above, I started to suggest in my article from the year 2009 the concept of expropriation, which I think is much more exact, correct. It should reflect the factual situation where the agenda of equal rights of the sexes as such and the connected measures that were adopted were not coming from above as something violently imposed on women, but instead it was stolen, alienated, expropriated from its genuine actors. The concept of expropriation has been so far used as related to the expropriation and nationalization of private property of bourgeoisie, farmers, and others in the name of communist doctrine, but also in the belief, and that's important, that has to do with all this expert story, in the belief that through centrally planned economy, it would be governed better. So I believe the same was at stake in the process of expropriation of the agenda of women's activism. It was explicitly stated by the communist president Zapotocki that the new regime will solve the so-called women's question on the scientific basis so that the coffee clubs of bourgeois women are no more necessary. Part of my colleagues in the team found the concept of appropriation useful, and it became, so to say, a transversal concept. Yet even the concept of expropriation does not fully cover the situation. It's namely a question to which extent the new communist legislation concerning these issues came from the conviction in the lawyers themselves and to which extent they were inspired by feminist goals. For what must be further stressed in the story is quite a big personal continuity with regard to the experts in all disciplines we were dealing with. It's logical because the system did not have, at least at the beginning, other experts. It needed those who were scientifically socialized in the interwar First Republic, Czechoslovakia, or even in the old monarchy, as was the case of the first chair of the named State Population Commission, František Pfeiffer. But he was by far not the only one. Věra Sokolová shows what an important role played the founder of the Czech sexology and of the interwar period, Karel Hynýa, in the sexology under communism. He was also collaborating with the State Population Commission, where he very much advocated broader sexual education. He proposed, for example, that the young men be sexually educated during their military service, where they have nothing to do anyway. An example of the continuity of both experts and agenda is the abortion law, which came in power in 1957. This subject was recently investigated by my student Andrea Prajerová in her diploma on the historical continuity of arguments in favor of abortion, and she was comparing the discourses of the 1920s and 1950s. The so-called Commission of Professors was working on legislation, pro-abortion legislation in the 1920s, and part of their arguments were simply transferred to the new discussions already in the communist era in the 1950s. So as I see it now, the concept of expropriation can be applied to the basic guidelines of the communist gender politics, which were at the same time connected with brutal silencing of those who have articulated them until then, that is, women's activists. But those guidelines could easily meet ideological convictions and position of a part of the experts. Yet here another important power relation occurs, namely that of substitution. For the expert activities, started replaced the missing articulation from below, this the feminist one. In my analysis, I seek in what sense the substitution was working and in which not. So, but here I can't go in depth in those things. The other part of the problem with the concept of enforced emancipation is that the very concept of emancipation is too undifferentiated, should be taken apart. It includes the process of gaining independence of women in their male on their male partners, which is connected but not identical with the modernization of public social status of women. But its strongest connotation, the history of feminist thought, is first of all the inner liberation of women from dependencies of any kind. In this last sense, the expression emancipation from above equals a nonsense. Each of these processes can be found in the history of the women's question during the state socialism, but it should be unraveled separately, targeted separately. In connection with the state socialist era as gender, I always prefer to use the concept modernization without liberation. Now I tend to slightly revise it as well. I am revising also my own concept from the 1990s, some of them. The modernization by the governmental policies was limited, for it practically neglected things like vertical segregation, pay gap, and alike. And in turn, they actually also were satisfied with the fact that women work for less money. It was economically good for the regime. And in turn, even in the situation of the absence of feminist articulation, the process of personal independence definitely was of women was going on, leading to the inner liberation, although limited as well. We have been repeatedly challenged by our colleagues Gerlinda Schmausova and Anna Wagnerova, who emigrated to West Germany in 1970s to take seriously their experience that as women, they felt freer in Czechoslovakia. As citizens, of course not. So the second concept I'm revising, or our team is revising, is that of state feminism. Don't worry, I will be so ample on the other concept, much shorter than the first one. The concept, as it has been used in political science dealing with democratic societies, does not apply to the communist history. For in the concept, in the definition of it, a triangle of government, state, experts, and feminist activism must be always present, which was here not the case because the feminist activism was absent. As I said, the role of the replacement of feminist knowledge played rather the expert scene, but it played in a very limited and incomplete way. For the second, it can be identified with the state either, which I already was discussing. Okay, so when I said in a conference that I'm about to revise the concept of state feminism, so all my colleagues from the former Communist Party say, "Oh, what are you doing?" We all agree that this is a bearing concept. This is a very important concept. So we are really quarreling, discussing a lot. And because I was really on base of this new research I showed now, that it was not feminism. There was something very, very basic was missing. And so then we agreed that more correct concept would be state socialist feminism, because then you can include also the experts' work and also the work, the limited work of social of women's organizations. So it was the feminism under state socialist era, but. But state feminism would be really, I'm really sure it's not so good now. The third concept or assumption is says that feminism is imported after the 1989 from the West. I was already pointing in the feminist history as part of the local tradition, but I also said that it was eliminated. Thus, as related to the role of experts, I suggest a claim that the experts, and I know this is a very important the thesis, the experts were substituting the contemporary absence of feminism, I mean contemporary the state feminism, state socialism, in the ideological framework of past feminism. So the old concepts, old frameworks from the pre-communist time were in the heads of those who were trying to keep it alive under communism, you know, but the topical voice was missing of women, so they could not react even for the measures they were introduced. There was the women's reaction was absolutely impossible. They were silent, so it was a very peculiar situation, you know. So, but that you can see how important is when you speak about experts, and but this is an so far. There was no such a research. Ildiko Astosh-Morash did something, she started also with that, but it's only the beginning of this kind. But this thesis that experts were substituting the contemporary absence of feminism in the ideological framework of the past feminism, it applies only to the practical politics. In the culture, feminist ideas live their own life, from the interval period, from whatever. My colleagues who pursue discourse analysis of literature or film identified what they call either latent feminism, so the film theorist Petra Hanáková, or proto-feminism, so the cultural studies scholar Libora Oth-Indruchová. It should be added that in the eve of the Prague Spring, that is the end of the 60s, a very promising discussion started in Literární noviny, that is literature journal, in reaction on the Czech translation of Simone de Beauvoir's Second Sex. So I was analyzing the discussion. I can only shortly say about that this discussion could have been the first step towards radical constructivist rethinking of the so far old-fashioned theorization of the women's question, which is a vocabulary of 19th century almost. But the military invasion in August 68 violently interrupted also this potential cultural development. Typically enough, those who participated in the discussions went away. It was Jan Patočka, for example, who died then, being persecuted by the communist regime. So you can see that also this personal continuities and that there was something there in the soil, some feminist soil, but it was again violently interrupted. The fourth concept is now it's concerning men. So after all, the men would be satisfied who are here, there would be something for them also. Our team was looking for the men's side of the story where it was possible. Unfortunately, there was much less material, but there was some. The common sense belief concerning this time the men's position was about men as a weaker sex. The contraposition sounds superwomen versus small children, meaning men. In our research, issues concerning men were for the major part present as those which were vastly omitted in the state socialist practical policies and theories, but we know that it's also gender politics. Thus, men's rights as fathers were left in total vacuum, legal vacuum, though the experts close to the State Population Commission pointed at the problem sufficiently and repeatedly. That the power did not listen this time to this claim supports the claim by Joanna Govan, another scholar who recently makes another new research, that fatherhood was rhetorically encouraged but not incorporated into the masculine ideal in the communist socialist era. The peculiar situation raises a question or a hypothesis that the rationalized governing style was very much based on the principle of the specialization of roles, of the segmentation of the society to clearly defined groups with clearly defined tasks and roles to be easily governed. This idea seems to be supported from an unexpected side in the analysis of gender symbolism in the mass exercise performances, the so-called Spartakiads, as Peter Robal analyzed them in his chapter. With men being omitted in practical politics may be connected a symbolic void of acceptable masculinity models, whereas there were several female models, symbolic models for women to identify with. Libora Indruchova documents in her discourse analysis this void of acceptable masculinity. Family and parenthood, then one must add also the responsibility for functioning partnership, were very strongly defined as the female tasks, which is richly documented through the analysis of the marital advisory books, mainly written by psychologists. The analysis was pursued in the project by Ivan Vodochodsky and Petra Klvačová. Through this type of analysis, the mosaic of factors that led to such a striking exclusion of men from gender-related thought and practice was put together. The constructions of masculinities were directly identified in the films by Věra Chytilová, by our colleague Petra Hanáková in her chapter. Kateřina Kolářová, who was analyzing discourse about HIV/AIDS in the late 1980s as gendered, too found different discourse on HIV that in the West and in our country. And also in her material, men stand for negative or ridiculous aspects of social life and symbolize lower moral. So actually, you could argue that the concept of the weaker sex was actually confirmed by our research, but it's a slightly different. It's not just weak. There are new contents which we identified, and in a sense, men were also freed of many kinds of responsibility, of the breadwinner, because women were expected to be breadwinners with the men, of the partnership, child care. So what means weak, you know? So in a sense, the discourse is very much kept actually certain aspects of patriarchal order, which were also favoring men in many, many aspects. Our research also identified the opposite, the roots of new anti-feminism. We often heard that the anti-feminism in our countries, post-communist countries, is a result of this enforced emancipation. But you could, in the analyzed text, you could clearly identify construed anti-feminism in the most famous works by Milan Kundera, by Bohumil Hrabal, and other icons of the Czech literature. That was fantastically analyzed by the literature theorist Jan Matonoha in our team. And he documented that in the discursive processes in this literature, that they had the effect of silencing gender debates in the Czech cultural context, that the paradoxical role of most dissident cultural and literary elites, that they played the role of delegitimizing feminist agenda. I can't explain it in detail how he showed it, but it's really fascinating because in the name of the higher, more important issues of the battle with the totalitarian oppression, etc., very sexist models were used, literary models were used, which actually paralyzed the discussion on this very, very sex or gender questions. You know, so it was there was a very, very fine, sophisticated mechanism of silencing and delegitimizing feminist idea. So the fifth, the relatively popular common belief, and also in experts very often, which must be challenged, is that of the alleged solidarity between the sexes under communism due to the existing common enemy. This is an explanatory figure which you can find in the dissident utterances very often. But in our research, the psychologist Katarzyna Zabrocka analyzed, using the critical discourse analysis, documents rather the opposite. She analyzed interviews with 20 women, and the interviewed women too do not recognize men as reliable partners, but at the same time reflect that men are not able to recognize women, that to establish equal partnership is, due to the men, impossible, both in public and private lives. Bitterness regarding the issue of gender equality was the dominant tone here. So the concept of solidarity between the sexes did not prove true either, at least in our material. Okay, I will skip because I think it's too long, too much for you. And try to come to periodization. Okay, so to come to the question, feminism East-West. What I was trying to show that first, the actors were not so isolated from the discourses and discussions or scholarship abroad as it may seem. Nevertheless, at a certain moment, it was true until the end of the 60s. But in Czechoslovakia, after the Soviet invasion, the development and the contacts were smaller. And first of all, the most important thing, and what I feel really very strongly, is that the problem up to now is that of lacking development of constructivist thinking and actually of radical feminism. That this old-fashioned theorization of gender issues is still persistent, is very hard to break, because the radical feminism, don't mean militant feminism. By radical feminism, I mean the new analytical apparatus, the whole concept of gender order, or sexual order, all the mechanisms of naturalizing, construing it, etc. So this is very, this is really missing. So there was certain development in the society without these new analytical tools. So even when these women I just quoted were actually very sensitive to the problem of the sexes, they were lacking the vocabulary to name it. They were not, they didn't know how to really analyze it or how to reflect upon that. So I think that the whole gender theory is extremely useful. I personally did never have problems with using it as analytical tools. They are perfect. The relationship with private-public sphere, this is also one of the feminist concepts which radical feminism has brought about. The process of construing gender, this is everything is good. But on the other side, I do believe that there is something very specific in these countries still. Although I'm the one who does not like the construction of the of the differences, but what is specific is that you speak with the women, you look at the at all the discourses. Women were actually construed as strong, independent, autonomous being, although only responsible for the family well-being. So you have, as Foucault would say, the objectivation of the subject was of a free, autonomous, independent subject, financially independent, for example, but at the same time strongly committed to a community, so individual and not individual. And this is a very peculiar pattern, which is very hard to prove as having discriminatory consequences. You know? So the specific role is that or the role of feminism today would be, and it's very hard, it's on the in the cultural level mostly, because the practical measures such as long maternity leave, very good protection of mother, child, and those things, they persist. The benefits are quite generous, I think, during the maternity leave, really, you know, so it's much better than it was earlier. So this on the practical level, that remained, but there is a very specific block. I will show you an example of what I mean on the analysis, on the example analysis of Sharka Gyurcsa, who was not a member of our team, but recently was analyzing current advices by the material experts in our country. And she shows that the typical discursive pattern is that it's first recognized that the patriarchal egoism in a man and their tendency to be served at home must be denounced because it's not justifiable in the 21st century. So there is this modernization shit. But the wisdom that follows is women should consider whether they themselves would be sexually attracted by men who do domestic chores, for due to the natural instincts, they can only be attracted by the alpha men. That is, men who to whom they can look up. So this is a very tricky, very sophisticated. So the patriarchy has been denounced. This is not anymore acceptable in our society. But then you find another way how to keep the old order. So, but this is very, very difficult to attack such figure. So, and Gyurcsa documents the continuum between this type of advices and those which were widespread and popular under communism, which were also analyzed. The only difference today is that the older variant would sound, if you make him help you with your domestic work, he will run away. So that was the discourse under communism. Now this is more sophisticated. So you may object that there is nothing specific in any of these phenomena, but I'm afraid that there are differences in both modification and intensity due to the long period where the gender culture became silently reconstructed, I mean under communism, not properly reflected upon. So I think draw conclusions that there must be parallel feminisms, that there is a very specific task by the feminist scholarship in our countries, not only in Czech Republic, but in the others as well, that for that you need urgently radical feminism, also post-structured feminism, although I'm not sure. Post-structural feminism happened to become a sort of fashion, although it's perfect. It goes more in depth, of course, in gender analysis. But at the same time, it's somehow easily adopted as a nice discourse, intellectual discourse, without the emphasis on the inequality, sexisms, etc. So it allows somehow to be discussed without feeling gender inequalities, stereotypes, sexisms, etc. Difficult in our countries, at least in our country, Even very attempts to discuss gender matters seriously. So there were many attempts in the television, for example, to discuss feminist issues. It had to be humor. They never organized it in a serious way. It had to be something fun about this. So feminists were soon labeled here in our country as those who were lacking sense of humor, when they don't laugh to the sexist jokes, etc. So, and humor is a cultural value that the Czechs are so proud of. I already said that, the conclusion. I think the post-communist location, unfortunately, is still relevant for feminist theorists and practice. Speaking about parallel feminisms is definitely relevant in terms of the very concrete contents and strategies, but at the same time, since the analytical apparatus was developed in the West, in its formal way, it's perfectly useful for our analysis. I never found problems with using, be it theories by Pierre Bourdieu, who had very similar, analytical approach like feminists, or the radical feminism or the later. Unfortunately, when feminism is flourishing in our country, it's very essentialist, which we also that prevails, dominates so strongly. So the deconstruction is missing. The awareness of the Konstruiertheit. I can't find the German, the English word from the Konstruiertheit. That's the most difficult thing, and that's a specific task because I think the Western society. The point is that in the West, and I have many experiences, many contacts there. The intelligentsia, at least, does understand that. But in our country, its problem is in the intelligentsia, even. Even in many sociologists, they tell you that pay gap is a consequence of natural division of labor and finito. That's what your sociologist colleague tells you. So that's a problem. So if the power elites do not get into the constructivist discourse, it's a very hard work. So I would finish with that. As to the collaboration, I never had problems, so maybe I'm not the right person for for that. Okay, thank you.